The information and opinions presented in this ARC Energy Ideas podcast are provided for informational purposes only and are subject to the disclaimer link in the show notes.
This is the ARC Energy Ideas podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas podcast. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Welcome back. And Jackie, we have some exciting news for our next podcast.
Yeah, if you're following us on social media, you already know. But next Monday, June 22nd at 1 p.m., Peter and I are inviting you to join a live stream conversation with the Honorable Seamus O'Regan.
Yeah, that's going to be a great one-hour session. It's going to be live streamed on video, but then we're going to convert it into a podcast as well. So stay tuned either way, live or follow up in audio.
And I'll put a link to register in our show notes. There's other ways to do it just through social media. You can find the link, but I'll put it right there if you can join us. And like we say, we'll have the podcast version. And it's a time of a lot of change right now, so we're really interested to get his view.
Things are changing. The lockdowns are easing. We're into what's called phase two here in Alberta. The economy seems to be revving up again. Gasoline consumption and traffic congestion is increasing. That is a byproduct of all of that. But then so too are emissions. And it seems that the whole subject of emissions and climate change has taken a backseat to the pandemic news and all the other nastiness in the world of late. But we're going to talk about it again today because it's certainly not an issue, that of climate change, that has gone away. And in that regard, we have a special guest today.
Yeah, we're excited to introduce David Keith, professor at Harvard's Kennedy School and also of Applied Physics at the Harvard School of Engineering and Applied Sciences. Welcome, David.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Yeah, welcome, David. It's great to have you. Well, so we're going to broach three subjects today. We're going to have a bit of a background on the current state of the climate science, where we're at. We're going to talk about the pros and cons of various emission reduction solutions that are being offered. And third, we're going to talk about David's specialty, which is something called geoengineering. And we're also going to talk about other modalities of trying to reduce emissions going forward. Should be a great discussion.
Okay. So before we get going, though, David, could you give our audience a brief summary of your background, some of the books and affiliations you've had, and what you're up to these days?
Grew up in Ottawa, physics background originally. I've worked in climate change since 89 or something, when I was a grad student at MIT, and I got interested in the topic and began to get involved in public policy around climate. And since then, I've kind of wandered back and forth between doing real kind of energy technology and policy. I spent a decade in Calgary, University of Calgary, working a lot on CO2 capture and storage and work on wind power and other things. I've also done work on climate observations. I as a postdoc, huge effort into working to build a proposed a satellite and flew a high-altitude aircraft mission to measure temperatures from space. And what I've done most of the last decade has really been focused on these ideas of solar geoengineering.
So your accomplishments have taken you all the way to Harvard. And I understand, though, you've moved back to Canmore in part.
Yeah, I split my time, but this is definitely long-term home. I intend to keep working for at least a decade or so at Harvard, but here I'd say half-time physically or even a little bit more over the next while.
Well, we're glad to have you back, so welcome back. So let's talk about the climate science. And you know, where I want to start is just from the basics, you know, even winding back, a decade or so, where we started talking in earnest about this threshold of 450 parts per million of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere. We're currently, from what I just gathered off the Mauna Kea, Hawaii measurement site, around 415 parts per million. So could you just tell our audience what happens at 450 and when are we expected to get there?
There's no strong scientific evidence that there are sharp thresholds in at least the global climate response. So you're referring to thresholds that are political, like the idea of 2 degrees centigrade or other thresholds that come out of part of the negotiations as a negotiating strategy to try and get more action.
Yeah, I mean, it's a continuum of measurements and levels and so on that you go through. And the climate is a very sort of dynamic and I'll call it a long wave phenomena that's changing, although it is the warming effects from a long-term perspective appear to be changing quite quickly, right?
Well, I mean, warming is now essentially completely driven over the next centuries by human activity and principally by long-lived greenhouse gases, by CO2 most of all. And I think what we know is that the risks grow certainly faster than linearly with total climate change or with cumulative emissions, for sure. But all I'm saying is I don't think there's evidence for clear thresholds.
Yeah.
There are lots of uncertain events with sort of big, big uncertainty bands, like what would be the pace for collapse of some of the big continental ice sheets, West Antarctica or Greenland. So those are things with huge uncertainties and hysteresis or nonlinearity. But what I think there isn't evidence for is that there's some kind of preponderance of all these sharp edges at, say, 2 degrees C. Talking about tipping points is useful politically, and there's no question that there are local ecosystem responses that have sharp thresholds, but it's not clear there's some kind of single... There's little evidence. Let me turn this around. It would be much easier to negotiate politically if there was a clear scientific threshold. And I think everybody gets that. I had this early experience as a postdoc, actually, where I got to talk to Paul O'Neill, at that point the CEO of Alcoa, and moved on to be Treasury Secretary in Bush 1, as I recall. And Paul was talking to our group at Carnegie Mellon, and he, in this kind of really simple way, he just said, like, tell us what the target is, and then we can design climate policy to meet the target. The problem, of course, is there isn't a single scientific target. It's inherently a policy decision that's a trade-off between risks and costs.
So, David, first of all, I really enjoyed your book, and I will put a link to the book, Case for Climate Engineering, because you had a lot of good background in there in terms of climate models and the uncertainties. And one thing that you talked about that I thought was really fascinating, and a lot of people don't recognize, is that the CO2 levels in the atmosphere don't go down immediately. We've loaded the atmosphere with carbon, and you could reduce today, but many of the long-term effects are going to be the same because we've put that CO2 in the atmosphere. Could you explain that carbon loading?
Yeah, I think it's probably the single most important thing to know about climate is if you just think about CO2 emissions, and you think about like a 100 or a couple hundred year time scale, it's more or less a one-way valve. Climate change is proportional to cumulative emissions. So that means when you bring emissions to zero, you don't reduce climate change, you just stop it getting worse.
But the CO2 lingers, in other words, right? It lingers in
the atmosphere. Yeah, well, it's actually a little more complicated. So CO2 has several different lifetimes. There's a short lifetime for equilibration of the surface ocean, and then a longer lifetime for deep ocean, and then longer still lifetimes, sort of 1,000-year lifetimes for some ocean chemistry equilibration. So it's not like CO2 lingers forever, but it fades pretty slowly. But at the same time, there's climate feedback. Turns out that the net effect of the CO2 response and the climate feedback response means that global temperature change is pretty linear in cumulative emissions over 100 years or so. Proportionality constant, we don't know very well. So one of the huge uncertainties is how much climate change we get for a given amount of CO2. That's one of the deep uncertainties and all the uncertainties in the climate response. But I think that core linearity is something that we've been pretty confident about.
Well, an interesting thing is because of that, people could make real sacrifices in the next 10 years to reduce the CO2 emissions. But it would be too late. The CO2 emissions in the atmosphere are going to mean that the climate's going to warm quite a bit anyway, and you're not going to see the benefits from some of the sacrifices you make over the next 10 years.
I don't think that's correct. Too late implies there's some kind of sharp threshold, which I really don't think there's evidence for. Every cumulative extra piece of emissions increases climate risk and harms our kids. So cutting emissions no doubt benefits the future.
I've had this question from a lot of people recently that, look, we're in the pandemic, we've locked down, emissions must be going way down. Therefore, the measurements of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere should go down. That's just not the way it works, because once you load it, it's there. It just means we're not, at the moment with the pandemic, we're not loading it as fast as we normally do.
Yeah, I mean, there's almost no effect at all. The pandemic has only dropped emissions by, I don't know what, probably over the years, like, I mean, more than 20%. And concentrations, the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, is the integral of emissions over a century. So emissions are still going up. They're just going up 20% slower this year.
Yeah.
Concentrations are a big deal.
Yeah. Okay. It's a big challenge. It's a big challenge. Since industrialization, we've been loading the atmosphere. It's at this 415 level. It's starting to get to the point where we're starting to see the effects, but there still is a lot of predictive uncertainty going forward that also leads to political consequences. So, you know, you have some people that say that...
No, I want to push back. I don't think that the politics is coming from real scientific uncertainty. The politics is coming because some people are going to lose. So I think the politics is coming because of a trade-off between, you know, the local people in Calgary legitimately are going to lose They're going to lose their livelihoods. It's going to hurt as we transition off fossil fuels. And people don't like that, which is completely legitimate.
Yeah.
But I mean, just to be clear, if you're a kind of a rational, dispassionate actor acting in the public interest, the scientific uncertainty has consequences. But that doesn't mean that you don't act. There's no version of scientific uncertainty that says that we shouldn't act to reduce emissions.
Yeah, nobody's saying, a few people, I would argue, will say we shouldn't act. And I'm not speaking about the local circumstance. I'm just thinking, you know, even in the broader worldwide conversations about climate change, as I read all the literature, certainly not all the literature, but a lot of literature, that there is a wide variance between expectations of outcomes, say 2050, as a consequence of where we're at vis-a-vis temperature increase. You know, there's probably like, you can tell us, like a 5 to 10 to 1 dynamic range between what's possible in terms of warming.
Yeah, I mean, maybe not quite that big mid-century, but late century, the uncertainties are certainly a order of factor 2, and then the uncertainties and other impacts are bigger still. Yeah, for sure.
So wherever you're at in the world, you're basically looking at this and saying, okay, some people say, well, it's not that bad, therefore, let's just carry on and no problem, all the way to disaster. And so I think that this sort of polarization in opinion and the uncertainties in the outcomes leads feedback into the politics of the situation, wouldn't you say?
I would say some, but I think that the people's divergent views about whether it's okay to just kind of keep going and not worry too much or whether really drastic action is needed is mostly not related to uncertainty in the science. It's mostly related to self-interest. That's what I see.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's certainly a lot of self-interest in the world.
There's nothing wrong with self-interest. It's the reality of public policy questions like this, that there are opposed interests and we need to settle them.
Well, we always certainly hope the self-interest on either side leads to some rational decisions in the middle. But let's continue on.
Yeah, let's talk about how we could reduce emissions. I think everyone agrees that, you know, there may be different trajectories that people think we should get on, but that they should be reduced. How optimistic are you that the current solutions that are being proposed, a lot of that around renewable energy and supply side solutions, are going to be enough to decarbonize in any meaningful time frame to deal with the urgency of the climate change challenge?
Yeah, I'm happy to have a go at that, but let me just go a little stronger than reduce emissions. I think the point is, if you want a stable climate, you have to reduce emissions to zero. You have to eliminate them. That's a consequence, a simple first year mass consequence of the fact that climate change is proportional to cumulative emissions. So we're not talking about reducing emissions. We're talking about eliminating emissions. The only argument is about how quickly we do it. And there are reasonable arguments that you should take a century to do it. Other arguments you should do it in a few decades. But unless you are really saying you want the climate to warm to that limit, you need to eliminate net emissions.
Yeah, and that's, you know, a challenge when we have a century of embedded infrastructure that is based off of emissions, basically. And actually, on that note, I mean, I sort of point our audience to a vignette in my energyfile.org collection, which people can go to. It's a top tourist attraction is the name of the vignette. And it's a picture, it's a postcard of the River Rouge Ford plant taken, about 7 years ago. And this is a photograph from the, it was actually a tourist site where you could go visit the plant. It just shows the emissions belching out of the steel plants, you know.
That's one of these great examples of how slow some of the industrial infrastructure is to turn over. Yeah, completely agree. So I'm happy to talk about how we reduce emissions. I just want to kind of clarify that I think the debate ought to be about how quickly we're driving towards zero.
Driving to zero is, even in a pandemic with everybody locked down, let's just take oil consumption as a proxy. Like, Jackie, what was it?
Yeah, about half of the world's population was locked down. And we did that back of the envelope calculation to say if we could annualize that change for the whole year, it would be the equivalent of about a 17% drop in greenhouse gas emissions. And then since that, actually, some other much more detailed studies have come out that came to similar conclusions. So even with half the world not doing much, it really just made a fairly small dent in the overall annual emissions.
Yeah. So let's get back to the question, David. You know, how optimistic are you that the current solution set that we certainly hear about in the headlines, which is an intense push for more renewable energy to displace fossil fuels, is going to be able to get us to zero emissions anytime soon?
soon is all about the politics of how much money we want to spend. And there's where there are really differences of interest. I don't think there's any doubt that you can do deep decarbonization with at least some renewables. I mean, I turn around and say, like, the world needs energy. We're not going to decrease consumption of energy, I don't think. And I think this stuff about the coronavirus is kind of silly. It's not, nobody seriously talking about reducing global energy use towards zero. I want to increase energy use because there's billions of people who don't have access to some of the great things that energy brings. The issue is we need to shift the heavy infrastructure of the energy economy to make it carbon free. And if you think that you want to live in the world is now coming up towards 20 terawatts of primary power, whatever it is, that's going to be like 30 or something mid-century, and you want to do it carbon free, then you got to think about what energy sources can supply that without themselves having huge environmental impacts. And from my point of view, I think there are really only two that are really big enough to do that easily without big impacts, and that's solar power and nuclear power. So, you know, solar power, you can do that with less than 1% of the global surface covered with solar systems. There's real evidence the cost trajectory supports that. Nuclear power has got its own issues, but it's clearly possible. I don't think there's really anything else. You're not going to do 20, 30 terawatts with biomass or wind or tidal or something without having huge impacts.
So, David, what do you think about, you said that your two top technologies would be solar and nuclear. But what about using oil and gas and then capturing the emissions so that it is a net zero source of emissions? And I know you're involved with carbon engineering where you're directly capturing CO2 from the air. Do you think that could be part of the long-term future energy mix?
It can be some, but I don't see that much. I mean, oil is principally fantastic as a transportation fuel. That's what's so great. It makes this high energy density transportation fuel. And I think there are going to be niches where you want that. But I think in the long run, you can't take oil out of the ground and burn as a transportation fuel without net emissions. I mean, yeah, you can do carbon removal, so that's a possibility. But I don't think that's like a long-term future for oil. For gas, I think there will be an intermediate period where natural gas peaking without CCS, but it's just relatively low emissions intensity for electric power sector, or natural gas peaking with CCS will go. But on the other hand, I think in the electric power sector, fossil is going to be outcompeted by other things, not tomorrow, but over decades.
Yeah, so you're painting a picture of a time imperative, painting a picture of, you know, some of these technologies being too expensive, and just a sense of urgency. So I'm going to now turn over to your book from 2013, A Case from Climate Engineering. So there's another possible solution set, and that is to engineer the Earth such that we decrease the amount of solar radiation that hits the Earth. So this whole area of climate engineering, which is your expertise, can you talk a bit about that?
So solar geoengineering is the idea that humans might deliberately alter the Earth's reflectivity by putting aerosols in the stratosphere or in altering low-lying clouds or something in a way that could reduce some of the risks of accumulated carbon dioxide. So I wouldn't call it an alternative solution set because solar geoengineering alone can't solve the problem. I think the way I would do it is step back and say, what are the ways we manage climate risk? And there's basically four. You can do decarbonization, which breaks the link between the energy economy and emissions. You can do carbon removal, which breaks the link between emissions and long-term concentrations. You can do solar geoengineering, which at best partially breaks the link between concentrations, the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, and climate change, and you can do adaptation, reduces the local consequences of climate change. So my sense is any serious strategy ought to at least consider all four. I think we want to do all of them for sure, with the possible exception of solar geoengineering, where I think we don't clearly know enough yet to be able to say whether or not it makes sense. My view is it makes sense to do serious research.
Just explain to our audience what geoengineering is and how it would stop the warming. And in your book, you talked about the things that it could actually potentially reduce the planet's warming by half.
So solar geoengineering is this idea that of adding aerosols. So one particular method would be to add aerosols. These are fine particles, sulfuric acid or calcium carbonate powder, what have you, to the stratosphere. And what I think we know is that technically it's doable to do that at costs that are low. We know that there are a whole set of environmental risks of doing it, from damaging the ozone layer to perturbing the way clouds work. And we now know something from all major climate models basically have been tested with these ideas. It looks like doing this could reduce many of the big climate hazards, changes in stream precipitation and temperatures and so on a pretty global basis. So I think the idea is that you might have some combination strategy where you cut emissions and in the long run do carbon removal, and then you use solar geoengineering to kind of cut off the top of the risk curve, to flatten the risk curve over some part of the century.
So basically, procedurally, it's loading up some higher altitude airplanes that zip around the Earth and spray sulfuric acid aerosol into the high altitude atmosphere, and as a consequence, increase the reflectivity of the Earth somewhat so that the solar radiation is lessened and the warming is lessened, therefore. Is that fair to say? And I think in your book, you said it costs about $1 billion maybe to do that?
One method, which would be putting sulfates in the upper atmosphere, that could be done with specialized new build aircraft that would fly into the kind of lower stratosphere around 20 kilometers, 65,000 feet or something. And you could do that from a few air bases near the equator. And that could be done in a way that produces a pretty even amount of aerosols east to west and north to south. And yeah, the evidence is that reduces not just temperatures, but it reduces the changes in water availability, it reduces storm intensity and so on, a range of things. But with lots of uncertainties and risks.
But as you say, just somewhat like doing a clinical trial on a human with a medication, we don't really know the unintended consequences on a regional basis. So in other words, you could have positive net benefits to one continent and negative to another because you're altering ultimately climate patterns. Is that also fair?
You certainly could. That's been one of the biggest concerns. And there's no question that there are ways that this could be done that would for certain have very unequal impacts. I think there's actually growing evidence that if this was done in a way where the radiative forcing, that is the amount of aerosol you're putting up, was pretty uniform, that the benefits in reduced climate changes would in fact be pretty uniform. And there's in fact not much evidence that you'd sort of necessarily make one region worse off. One of the big tensions here, and tension even like embedded in having the conversation with you folks, is a concern that this will be used as a get out of jail free card, a concern about moral hazard, the concern basically that the existence of these technologies will encourage people to keep emitting or embolden those who say that we don't need to cut emissions.
There is a lot of controversy for sure. Now, in 2013, you talked about a process that involved more research followed by some small trials that would start in 2020. So 7 years later, after you wrote the book, is there any progress towards this goal?
Yeah, there is. There's much more research globally. There's now been sort of 1,000 scientific papers published, which is, you know, some level of real interest. There are little research programs in lots of places, from, you know, several universities in India to China to Norway, Germany, U.S. There's a little bit in Canada. Australia has quite a program with a small set of field experiments. So on the one hand, there's certainly much more than there was 7 years ago whenever that book was written. On the other hand, you know, the total global research is still tiny, of order kind of 20 million a year out of a total atmospheric science research budget globally that's, you know, I don't know, over 5 billion. So I think the research is still really inadequate to give us the kind of robust understanding that would make sense for public policy. But there's definitely much more discussion and much more discussion at kind of high levels of the political world.
Mm-hmm. I like the way you characterize sort of the four solution sets, if I can call them that: decarbonization, removal, geoengineering, and adaptation. Let's talk a bit about removal. And I know Carbon Engineering is a company that basically tries to remove CO2 from the atmosphere on a large scale. Several oil companies, even here in Canada, have expressed interest in this technology, which is out of British Columbia. Can you talk about when that is going to be ready or what stage that sort of solution is at?
So there's both carbon removal generally and carbon engineering. So I founded Carbon Engineering. So obviously I've got a self-interest financially and intellectually in lots of ways. And I also talk more generally about carbon removal. Carbon Engineering is a startup we found in Calgary, but we didn't get that much support in Alberta at the time. So we moved to BC, where we got more support. It's going fantastically well, much better than I would have imagined. The company's now got more than 100 employees and us and really serious strategic investors and I think a reasonable pathway. You know, we're in the middle of trying to do the project finance. for a big first-of-a-kind plant. This is a kind of million-ton-a-year scale plant, so that has a kind of project finance cost of order $1 billion. And let me tell your listeners, that's really hard. And I think we've got a fantastic kind of CEO and board. And from my perspective as a, you know, I've really enjoyed the business side, but I'm not a business expert. And it's my first rodeo in terms of this complexity of the business. It's hard for me to judge the actual probability of us pulling off that financing. But I'd say, despite me being pretty skeptical about things, I think it looks pretty good. There's really a lot of factors lined up. I think that the core technology risk is really quite low. There's a bunch of sort of project execution risk, but a lot of some of the really big industrial players and EPC firms have now done really careful due diligence, and none of them have said there's a, you know, any big fundamental technical risk. The risks are really all about getting a small company to pull off a project at that scale with good cost control, and I'm really optimistic we can do it.
And when you capture the CO2 from the air, what do you do with it?
So there's a range of things, and indeed it's not direct air capture to me. It's simply a technology for taking atmospheric air and making concentrated CO2, and that may or may not be used to do carbon removal. So one thing you do with it is geologic storage, and then you're doing carbon removal. But another thing you do with it is do enhanced oil recovery, and depending on the lift ratio, you're basically making oil which is net neutral. So you're not removing carbon from the atmosphere in the net. You're just producing low carbon fuel, which is a huge benefit, obviously. Or I think if solar power or nuclear power got much cheaper, you could take the cheap hydrogen that you can make electrolytically and do hydrogen plus CO2 through Fischer-Tropsch or some more advanced process and make high energy density transportation fuels, hydrocarbon fuels, fuels that are chemically the same as hydrocarbons that would be compatible with existing infrastructure, but that did not come from the ground. So you'd be making fuels that would use primary energy source that might be solar or nuclear, but would have be compatible with you know, you could make aviation kerosene for aircraft. And I think that's important because while I think we might well decarbonize light duty vehicles with electric power, and I think we will, I think there are some parts of the energy system where you're going to want hydrocarbon fuels forever, potentially. But hydrocarbon fuels doesn't mean fuels you got from the ground. It just means hydrocarbons chemically, and you can synthesize those from cheap, low-carbon energy and CO2 you got from the air.
That's such an exciting idea. You know, CO2 has the carbon, and you can actually make liquid fuels from it again and have a cycle where there's no net CO2 going in the atmosphere. What other technologies do you find exciting in terms of capturing CO2? I know there's a lot of nature-based solutions like using the ocean or using nature like growing algae or planting trees. Do you think these are going to be really important in terms of meeting the climate challenge?
It's hard to tell. I mean, somewhat against the interests of carbon engineering, I do think that in the near term, the focus needs to be on cutting emissions. And I don't think that over the next few decades, really large scale carbon removal should play a big role. I think it just sort of common sense that in general, it's going to be cheaper to avoid emissions of a ton of carbon than to emit it and recapture it. The way I think about it is once we've decarbonized sort of more than half of the economy, maybe we're down to the last quarter, then it might be cheaper for some of that to just offset it by carbon removal. Now, if you want to be able to do that in a few decades, you socially sure as heck want to begin to develop these technologies now. So that's a justification for government support for things like carbon engineering and for market support that's happening. So I developing these technologies now is really terrific. I'm excited to be part of it. But I do think it's important to say that in terms of actual, you know, the massive flows of money to decarbonize, you know, right now we're spending about $300 billion a year globally on clean energy. And, you know, I'd like to see that doubled, you know, for the next couple decades. I think most of that should go to decarbonization, not to carbon removal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that $300 billion, even the International Energy Agency has identified it as being inadequate by half. Let me just ask you as we wrap up here, we started with talking about the 450 ppm and that notional target that was given to us. There's also the 2 degrees C target that is written into the Paris Agreement. Are you optimistic, you know, given all that we've talked about, all the potential ways of combating this issue, that we'll be able to keep temperatures less than 2 degrees C?
I think keeping temperatures under 2 degrees C without solar geoengineering requires some luck of having the so-called climate sensitivity be low, having the climate be less responsive than we think to CO2 ag, if you want to keep temperatures under 1.5, it gets pretty hard to do it without solar geoengineering. But I think that doesn't mean we should necessarily do solar geoengineering. There's real risks and trade-offs. These targets, you know, weren't handed down from God. They're just political artifacts. One thing it's important to say is it's so easy to talk about these very long-term 100-year goals. To me, that the near term is really what we do politically in the political lifespan of those of us now, you know, who in various ways have some of the reins of power. We need to be spending something closer to $1 trillion, so 3 times 300 billion, something closer to 1% of the global economy on decarbonization. And I think if that was happening, I feel we were doing a pretty good job. And I think that local step-by-step action is more important in some ways than a long-term target. And I think we should be developing carbon removal technologies and implementing them and trying to figure out how well they work and what their impacts are. And I think we should be really aggressively researching solar geoengineering to understand how it might play, what its risks are, et cetera.
Okay, good. Well, hey, we're running out of time here. Thank you very much, David. We've really appreciated your insights on this challenging issue. And we want to thank you for pushing forward a range of solutions, both on the policy side and the technical side, that are going to be needed to address the serious climate change challenge.
Yeah, thanks very much, David.
Thanks very much. Thanks for all your work. Thanks, Peter. You've been such a leader in the Calgary community in getting people to give out this over time. And I think it's a conversation that we really need to have.
Good. Thank you. And thank you to our listeners for joining our podcast. If you like this podcast, please rate us on the app that you listen to and tell someone else about us.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.